Welcome to Pivot Matters. I'm your host, Jeff Lynn. Thanks for tuning in today. On this show, we talk about the ever-changing landscape of healthcare payments and the impacts to healthcare payers, providers, and consumers. You can follow the conversation on Twitter at hashtag Payment Matters and follow me at Jeff B. Lynn. I'm excited for today's guest. We have Haas Rafat, who is the CEO of Vatica Health. And it's great to have you on today, Haas.
Thank you, Jeff. Glad to be here.
Yeah. I think for our listeners today, we'd love to kind of understand a little bit more about your background and experience, and you've had a long history within healthcare. We'd love to understand more.
Sure. So my background is, I was trained as a biochemist, then went on to get a medical degree at University of Virginia. And I've spent the last, 25 years in healthcare, specifically, typically health plan operations. So I was in finance early on, then moved on to actual health plan operations. I worked for Humana, Coventry, Munich Re, Windsor. So I developed a lot of expertise in running health plans, Medicare Advantage, commercial, Medicaid. And when I wasn't running health plans, I was, working in smaller companies, just trying to solve problems for health plans, just related to risk adjustment and quality, medical record retrieval, how to get products onto the new Affordable Care Act exchanges. So, I'm someone who's been on both sides, someone who's run health plans and also, been someone who's been a partner to health plans just to try and, solve the problems, that, create the most value for them.
Got it. So really the experience on both sides of the health plan and the providers, seeing both sides of that, I think that's a unique perspective here. You talked about risk adjustment here, and I think that might be a new topic for many of our listeners here. Can you maybe give a brief kind of high level overview of what that is and really how does that impact healthcare payments?
Sure. So, risk adjustment's, been around in the insurance industry for a long time, and it really became front and center with the Affordable Care Act back in 2011, most prominently when, the government said no more underwriting, right? But we want to make sure that we can subsidize the government-sponsored programs based on the risk that a health plan is taking. So the simple example I give is, my mom is 82 years old and, she's enrolled in a Medicare Advantage plan. And the base rate for her county is $10,000 a year. So that's what the federal government sends to whichever health plan she signs up with to cover her benefits, as well as the administrative expenses and profit for that health plan. And risk adjustment is simply making sure that that payment for my mom is adjusted for the expected utilization of services that she's going to have. So if the health plan documents that my mom has a lot of chronic conditions and that she has 20% more chronic conditions than the average Medicare Advantage member, that would be a risk score of 1.2. And that means the government would send that health plan $12,000 a year instead of $10,000 a year. Your mom might be very healthy, no chronic conditions, and she has a risk score of 0.9. And so the government would send $9,000 for your mom. And that's the math that just gets rolled up to 1,000 or 1 million members that defines the payment between the government and the health plan. And that enables the health plan to make sure it has collected enough money from the government to offer the benefits that are put out there for a consumer to choose. I think that's the simplest way I can describe it. There's some more complexity behind that in terms of the math, but at its simplest level, that's what's happening.
And so this is an interesting topic here, right? And it sounds, Haas, it sounds really simple when you really think about this. But, when I look at this and think about this, making the determination whether it's 9,000 or 12,000, call it the ratio for that, relies on kind of my assumption here is there's some underlying data that kind of governs and really kind of provides that visibility on how that population is gonna react there. So And I think payers, and it makes a lot of sense on how payers are going to be doing this in a Medicare Advantage plan, but can you talk about the data and how, you know, that, who's providing the data, how is that getting to the health plan so they can actually manage their risk pool for this?
Sure. And, you know, this risk adjustment applies to Medicare Advantage. It applies to the commercial exchange products. It applies to many Medicaid programs. So it's really universal in terms of its use, you know, for all those types of insurance. You're right on, though. The data is really, you know, at the center of all this, and that's what makes this, you know, difficult and complex. So the government really has to rely on the diagnosis codes that the health plan submits to the government in order for the government to be able to calculate the risk scores. Those diagnosis codes are, you know, basically the ICD-10 codes that are used out in the clinical practice. That's the coding methodology, you know, that's published so that there's a standardized method to gather that data. It's not only used for risk adjustment, it's obviously used, you know, for providers to properly document with great specificity, you know, what condition they're treating. The challenge is that those diagnosis codes are usually submitted on a claim, and they are not validated by the health plan because a claim in and of itself isn't sufficient evidence that a condition exists. The government wants to see more evidence in the form of a medical record that that condition is a current active condition that's being monitored, evaluated, assessed, and treated in the calendar year for which that condition is being considered for risk adjustment. And so the great challenge is that you've got all these diagnosis codes coming to you as a health plan, and you have to come up with a way to make sure that you are validating that those conditions, in fact, meet the minimum requirements that the government has established in order for them to be considered for risk adjustment with the appropriate coding and documentation. And that's where you start getting into all the complexity and all of the challenges that the health plans have as they try and, you know, reach out to providers to get that information.
Maybe for, you know, what does that mean here when there is a validation exercise, like to a health plan and to the provider itself? Is there any impact on either of those constituents?
Sure. So the first thing I'll talk about is the enforcement from the government. The government can do risk adjustment data validation audits. They're called RADVs. And that's the process where they'll select a certain number of health plans every year, and they will do an audit that is a random sample of the members there and look at the codes that were submitted by that health plan and review the evidence that validates that that condition exists and is being actively managed and treated. And so that's one mechanism of enforcement. And if you fail those audits, there are serious penalties and fines associated with that. There's also, you know, the OIG and DOJ, which will, you know, do their own investigations if they believe, you know, that there's any kind of fraud or misconduct as it relates to those codes and the risk adjustment premiums received by that health plan. So there's a variety of different mechanisms by which federal or state governments do the enforcement. But, you know, I just gave you an example of how that works for Medicare Advantage. So health plans absolutely, you know, have to make sure that they are prepared for those audits and that they have a process in place to make sure that they're validating these codes when they're being submitted so that they are in compliance with the rules and will pass an audit if they're selected. The biggest challenge in this whole process, there's really several, and I'll mention them. The first is that I'm a physician. When I went through medical school 30 years ago and even today, there's no training on coding. Number two, when you submit a claim as a provider, your focus is on making sure that you've described the services that you have delivered, and that those are coded. Those are called CPT or HCPCS codes for the services that I have rendered. But the only thing that you care about when you submit a claim for that service is that you have selected a diagnosis code for that service that means that that service was medically necessary. And there are just very broad rules around the diagnosis codes that can be used to support that service being submitted on a claim. And so there's been a lot of effort on the provider side to make sure the service codes that are selected are correct, but there's been little to no focus on the diagnosis code associated with that service, because there's such a broad range of choices that can be put on the claim to satisfy that minimum medical necessity. The third challenge is that it would be unrealistic for the provider to submit the medical record with every claim that they submit. And so you have a process where you have all these codes going into the health plan, but not the medical record documentation to validate that. The health plans want to make sure they're making timely payments. There are many rules around that to the provider to make sure that they're getting paid for the services that they deliver. And so the health plans are forced to come up with some other process to gather the information to actually validate those codes and have confidence in those codes before they submit them, or before the final submission where they have the opportunity to, you know, pull back some of the codes that have been previously submitted. So I hope that gives you a little bit of a feel for, you know, all the challenges associated with doing this in a complete and compliant way.
Yeah, I know it makes a lot of sense here. It's really a big three-pronged issue here. And clearly that makes sense on the audits that these health plans have to go through here. And, you know, the one question here is that, you know, there's a phrase, the garbage in, garbage out here, which is the claims that are coming through, the diagnosis codes may be incorrect, right? And to your point here that healthcare providers probably aren't trained on how to do this, in addition to the medical records being insufficient for this. What's the, from a provider's perspective, why do they care? Like, what's their reasoning for them to provide the medical record, creating the correct, you know, right diagnosis codes? Is there an incentive for them to code this right and to work with the payers correctly?
Yes, and I'm going to answer that question at a couple of different levels. At the most basic level, providers who are still just being reimbursed fee for service, meaning I provide a service, I send a claim, I get paid for that service. That's typically just called, you know, a fee for service arrangement. It's still important to get that diagnosis coding right when your patient is covered by one of these plans that are risk adjusted. And most of the insurance these days ultimately has a risk adjustment component, you know, sponsored by the government. And so the reason it's important to you is because if you don't communicate the conditions that my mom has and that Jeff, your mom has, at the end of the day, it means that the health plan is not collecting sufficient data to get the right risk adjustment premium from the government, which means that there start to be problems with that health plan being able to pay the claims for your mom and my mom, which then leads to the benefits being reduced that are offered in the next year, and starts to put pressure on the health plan to squeeze the payments that are made to the provider. It's kind of a downward spiral where, you know, ultimately the health plan can't get the appropriate premium from the government. And so benefits start getting weaker, reimbursement starts getting weaker, and that health system or that product offered by that health system, health plan fail. And so you have fewer and fewer good choices. That's why it's important for you, even just as a frontline provider, just receiving fee for service payments. If you're a provider that starts getting into value-based care arrangements where you're paid for the quality of your work as well as the financial performance of your care, you really want to make sure that those premiums that are being received from the government are as complete as they can be, complete and accurate, because at the end of the day, if you are measured on financial performance and you are paid a bonus based on financial performance, in addition to quality, which is always important, then you want to make sure that the premium is right sized for Haas's mom and Jeff's mom so that the claims for those ladies are still covered by the premium and that the financial performance is acceptable or, you know, performs better than the benchmarks that the health plan has established for you as a provider. I would also say, even on the measurement of quality, making sure that the right people have been accounted for in a quality measure for preventative screenings for breast cancer or for care of an older adult. Having accurate information to make sure that the denominator in those calculations really represents the true population that have a condition is critical. So good diagnosis coding affects both quality of care measures as well as financial performance calculations in value-based care. That's another reason that matters. The final reason is if you're really a provider or a large health system in a value-based care arrangement with a health plan, in more and more cases, that health plan is actually now transferring some or all of the liability as it relates to any penalties or fines associated with audit failures for risk adjustment. And so you now have the same pressure as a provider to make sure that you are confident that the codes that have been submitted are well documented to prove validation. So there's really a range of reasons, kind of depending on where you are in the fee for service to value based care scale, about why you need to care about diagnosis coding, and you need to make sure, you know, that you're implementing the steps that you can on your own or with the help of others, you know, to make sure that you do this completely and compliantly.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Payment Matters. I'm joined by Haas Rafat, CEO of Vatica Health, and we're discussing risk adjustment in healthcare. And I imagine, and I'll take a leap here, but keep me honest here, which is PCPs are very involved in this process here. Their lives are busy. Coding is hard. It's difficult here. How do you make sure, you know, how does that interfere? Like, does this added burden or added a kind of responsibility when this is being done, how does that impact these PCPs or these providers on the front end here? What changes as part of their workflow, if anything, in order to make sure that these needs are met tied to risk adjustment?
Yes, that's a great question. So the first thing I want to affirm for you is that PCPs are critical to great risk adjustment in terms of compliance and completeness. They're the people that sit at the center of the health system for that patient and are in the best position to have a complete and compliant view. Now, there's hospitalizations and there's specialists and procedures that all generate claims to the health plan. But at the end of the day, the PCP really needs to be the quarterback of all of that care and be able to have visibility into all those conditions, whether the PCP is actively treating them or whether, you know, a specialist is managing a particular chronic condition with a patient. And so the PCPs are at the center of doing this well. And so now comes your next question, which is, how do the PCPs do this? They're already so busy just with the volume of care that they have to deliver for these patients and the level of efficiency that they're expected to have by the health system, you know, that owns their practice or the health plan in terms of the amount of money that will be paid for a particular service. And so that's really where it's critical for the health plans to sponsor programs to support the PCP doing this other work for risk adjustment and quality and for overall for value-based care. The way those health plans sponsor that work can vary. Once again, starting all the way on the left with the provider that just, you know, gets paid fee for service, you know, one service at a time. You know, at the end of the day, the health plans need to make sure that they're providing extra payments in the form usually of incentives to complete certain work completely and compliantly. It's also critical that that health plan make it as easy as possible for those PCPs or their staff to do the work as efficiently as possible and within the existing workflows that that practice has. And that's where you start to get into some of the challenges of doing this well on a large scale. As you move up the scale to larger practices and health systems that are in these value-based care arrangements with health plans, the sponsorship takes different forms. It tends to be more performance-based. It's, hey, here are the performance metrics we have for quality and for financial performance. This is the way that you can pay for doing more of that work because you're going to earn bonuses to do that. And in some cases, sometimes these health plans will initially pay for, you know, certain upfront payments to get people into a value-based care arrangement so they can start putting the staff and initiatives in place to do this work, or they'll offer a vendor like our company, Batica, you know, to help implement these kind of programs. But ultimately, the ultimate financial sponsorship can come in the form of some direct incentives as well as some performance-based incentives. When you get to the large health systems that are fully capitated, where they're simply taking, you know, 85 or 90% of the premium from the health plan and are fully at risk for all the utilization for that member, then that's the complete sponsorship of that program, because now, you know, those health systems are really acting like the health plan, and they need to use some of that premium that they've been allocated to pay for these initiatives to make sure that that premium is properly risk adjusted and that the quality measures are properly calculated for the people that truly have those conditions. In all of these cases, whether the PCP is, you know, a one person practice all the way up to, you know, big health systems and clinics, it's critical that the health plan is making tools and services available to make this as easy as possible to implement, separate and distinct from the level of financial sponsorship that they put out there for those providers.
Got it. That makes, and this is a fascinating space. You know, I think we've talked a lot about the industry and what's going on here. I'd be interested in sort of what's Batica Health's, your company's role in this whole risk adjustment journey for payers and providers. You mind describing what Batica Health does?
Sure.
For these customers?
Happy to do that. So I'll just quickly tell you a little story to understand how I arrived at Batica. So as a health plan executive, you know, in order to try and get the documentation I needed to validate these codes that were coming in through claims, and to make sure that I really had complete and accurate documentation, I would often use vendors to go out and retrieve medical records from providers, as well as home assessments, where we would be sending nurse practitioners or physician assistants out into the member's home to do a health assessment. I never really liked those solutions as a health plan executive because it really wasn't the ideal way to get complete and compliant coding. The retrospective chart retrieval is looking at medical records that have already been documenting previous encounters, but at the end of the day, they don't always have the rigor associated with the coding specificity or the documentation that the government requires. And so it's not a great source of validating these codes on the claims or documenting new codes that weren't on the claim. Health assessments are better. However, they still lack the connection to the people that were treating that patient, meaning there's rarely access to the EMR. There's really any connection to the PCP. These home assessments are just kind of being done completely separately from the care that's being delivered for that patient. So what interested me about Batica was that I saw an opportunity to use people and technology to actually get this risk adjustment and quality of care work done at the place of care, and specifically with the primary care physicians. And 6 years ago, I joined the company to really build that solution out. And it's the same solution that we offered 6 years ago. It's just been enhanced and evolved, you know, to just continue to get better and better. And, you know, we serve over 200,000 members now across thousands of PCPs. And essentially what we're doing is we're taking nurses and administrative folks, and we are sending them into those primary care offices, pulling information out of the EMR, reconciling it with information from the health plan, and creating a simple 5 to 10 minute exercise that PCP can do once a year on a specific patient to make sure that coding is complete and accurate in terms of the chronic conditions that they're managing at that practice for that patient. So that's the operational solution. financially, we've also made sure that we have, for each of our health plan sponsors, negotiated incentives for those providers to do this work with us, either direct incentives or just tying into the incentives that they already have in a value-based care arrangement. So we're offering the operational and clinical support, as well as the financial sponsorship, to make sure that the PCPs can get this work done. And you know, our goal is to do 90% of this work so that there's nice, clean decision-making that the PCP can do in 5 or 10 minutes to make sure that it's complete and compliant coding. And then everybody wins. The patient wins, the doctor wins, the health plan wins, and the government, you know, is confident that they're getting the compliant codes to do risk adjustment properly for their overall program.
These are the PIM matters we're tackling today. And thank you to my guest, Haas Rafat, for joining me today. Haas, where can our listeners learn more about you and or Vatica Health?
Easiest thing to do is just go to vaticahealth.com. It's all there. And there's ways that within that website, they can just reach out and get more information from sales, whether they're a health plan or whether they're a provider. You know, we're happy to engage.
That's great. And once again, thank you, Haas, for joining me today. And thank you to all you listeners for listening in today. Remember that you can listen into this episode weekdays at 4:30 a.m., 12:30 p.m., and 8:30 p.m. Eastern. You can also listen to Apple Podcasts and Google Play Music, or just say, Alexa, play Healthcare Now Radio. If you have a comment about the episode of the show, follow hashtag Payment Matters or connect with me on Twitter at Jeff B. Lynn. You can learn more about my show at healthcarenowradio.com or at insmed.com. Until next time, I'm Jeff Lynn.